In my quest to look at the groups of the Merseybeat era, and in particular maybe people and places that I've known myself, I'm with lead guitarist Phil Norman, who was with the Prowlers, and the Prowlers were right from my very own neck of the woods. So Phil, first of all, thanks very much indeed for your time.
Okay.
And obviously these days I don't think the Prowlers are going as such, are they?
No, the Prowlers finished to all intents and purposes around 1967, having had roughly a 3-year run.
And before I go back to the band, how did your life pan out? What sort of things to get involved with?
What, after the Prowlers?
Yeah.
Well, after the Prowlers, which was a full-time occupation for a short time, it was a case of getting a job going, and I ended up in the civil service for a while, and then later on, because I had an art school and design background,
yeah,
I started a business with my younger brother. We were in the fitted kitchen business. I did the design work and some of the selling, and we had a design studio in Chester. That ran pretty well for 10 years, but the last recession of the late 80s, early 90s sort of undermined that.
Mm.
So I went back to the civil service again until I retired a little while ago.
Okay. It's just really to get a flavour of... A lot of people do have a misconception that, you know, if you were a musician, you obviously took lots of drugs and basically didn't do much else, you know. And the more that you get into this, because I've been talking with a lot of people now, you know, to just get a little bit more into the Merseybeat phenomenon, if you like. Let's go back to the very early days then. So which school would you have been at when you were deciding to play your guitar?
What school was I at?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'd left school by the time the Prowlers came along, but when I was first fumbling through my learning my first few chords and tunes and so on, I was at St. Anselm's in Birmingham.
Okay, this is interesting, because I was at St. Anselm's as well.
Oh, were you?
Okay, and do you know what inspired me to start playing a guitar? It was one Christmas, you remember we had the end of term sort of concert thing?
Yes.
And Larry Daintree got up on the stage to play Tom Dooley. And, you know, as a young kid watching, I thought it was fantastic. So were you about when Larry Daintree would be there?
I don't remember that name. The guitar playing guy that was most prominent at the time that I was there, and he was in the same year as me, was Ian Hunter.
Yes, I remember Ian Hunter.
Who, you know, later was in the Valkyries and various other bands.
Yeah.
He was quite, you know, everybody, at one point, everybody was getting a cheap guitar, and Skiffle was around, and people were fumbling through chords and so on. I remember he had this disadvantage that I recall. I think his mum was a music teacher. So he was like a couple of chords ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
And so that's really where it started. And I think the earliest influences would have to have been the rock and roll that we were hearing coming through from the USA. And we used to hear it courtesy of Radio Luxembourg on a scratchy radio receiver.
Yeah.
And people like Elvis, and in my case, I was particularly keen on Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers, people like that. And and some of those early rock and roll films, you know, they were all a great influence. Just, you know, seeing electric guitars for the first time, you know.
Yeah. So how did the Prowlers come about for you?
Well, the Prowlers grew out of the band called the Blackjacks that I joined. After St. Anselm's, I went to art school, and I was trying to get a band started then. The only trouble with trying to start a band is everybody expects you to have all the answers, like the place to practice. But, some sort of idea about transport and when are we going to get some bookings and all that sort of thing. And in the end, after a few false starts, I found it easier just to look for a band that was looking for a guitarist, and somebody put me in touch with a band with Canada with Blackjack. And we just about got started when we were a four-piece, like a Beatles-type lineup, if you like.
Yeah.
When Johnny, from Rhythm Guitar, announced that he was going to have to leave the band because the girlfriend was expecting. And so the guitar and the amplifier and the motorbike had to go.
Yeah.
So we were then without a guitarist and singer. And the other guys in the band had all been to the same school, and they bumped into Dave Stanton, who's a guitar player, and he'd been with a band called The Abstract. And he said, well, he'd be happy to join, but he felt that he wasn't strong enough to be a lead singer. But he suggested a chap called Alan Davis, who himself had just been in a band that had broken up and was available. So we became a five-piece band with a singer, two guitars, bass and drums. And that was very early in 1964. And largely through Dave's influence, we started on looking at old blues music for inspiration, but bringing it up to date for modern audiences, dancing audiences, because, you know, essentially bands in those days played to audiences that were dancing.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're rocking the blues up a bit. In those days, it was called R&B.
Did you often think back to our school days? I know for me, I never got any encouragement or any sort of help at all out of what we did at school, because I know we had the singing lessons. We also had the orchestra, and I remember playing the violin for a while. But you know, for me, nobody really said, "Well, you know, why don't you start a group or anything like that?" And my own dad didn't particularly like the music and that sort of stuff in the pop scene, you know.
I think you're right. There wasn't any encouragement around, because I think it was our music, wasn't it? It was completely alien to our parents. The only encouragement I got really was not to have anybody standing in my way. But as regards school and so on, it was just regarded as something quite alien. And the music lessons that you mentioned, for some reason or other, I ended up in the wind section, and I got a trumpet to blow, and didn't get very far with that, I must admit. But we thought the guy that we had teaching us the wind instruments was a bit racy, because he used to wear dark coloured shirts with his sports suit. Even that was a bit. Compared to the other teachers, all in silver ties and so on.
So,
role was completely alien to all of those people, I think. So we just had to do it for ourselves.
Yeah. So can you remember where your first big booking was?
First big booking? That's probably one of the earliest big shows that we did would have been at the Ballroom in Brighton. You know, if we're talking in terms of size of venue,
yeah,
and that would have been somewhere in the middle of 64, I would think, because the as you know yourself, the Tower was, I think, one of the biggest venues in terms of how many people you could get inside it that a band could play at in those days.
Yeah,
I think our good friend Ray O'Brien mentioned that it was the biggest UK venue the Beatles ever played at.
I think it certainly was, by the sound of things. You know, I
a very small audience these days, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because we've got all these arenas and places like that, but they didn't exist in those days. So even the biggest bands spent a lot of their time playing provincial theatres and fairly large dance halls, where the audience would generally be something like a couple of thousand, I would imagine.
Yeah. So did you get booking with an agency, or did you find your own bookings? How did you work that?
Well, to start with, we did it all on our own. To get the band known, Dave came up with this bright idea of printing off these cards with just a simple message on it, a Prowler's run. And we went around to all the dance halls, youth clubs, and clubs that we could think of, and just pinned these notices up without asking anybody. We just did it. So by the time the band was ready to start going out live, and we went along and said, how about giving some work? The Prowlers, oh yeah, I've heard of you. People have been asking about you. And it was just this little, simple little self-publicity routine. So that's how we got there. And we did a lot of work around the world, because there were lots of places to play in those days.
Yeah.
There were clubs, there were dance halls, there were places like the Majestic in Birmingham. There was the Tower, of course. That's even before you crossed the River Jersey and started playing at places like the Cavern.
Yeah, and did you do the Crawl?
Yes, we did.
Which of course became the Golden Guinea later, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yeah, we played the Crawl in the early days, and we also played in a little club called the Cubic.
Yeah, I remember the Cubic. That became the California, didn't it?
It did, yeah. That was a couple of hours away from the old Majestic.
Yeah.
And we played a little club up in Tranmere called the Left Bank.
Yes, I did that one as well, yeah.
Well, that was owned by a guy whose brother-in-law was Joe Brown.
Was it? No, I never knew that.
Yeah, and we met Joe up there. The fellow who owned it was called Neil Partington. His name just came back to me then.
Yeah.
And because we played there regularly and, you know, brought quite crowded, Neil said, I've got Joe coming up at the weekend. I think he was trying to get Joe interested in putting some money into the club.
Yeah.
And so Joe came along, and we just met, you know, when the club was closed one Saturday afternoon, and we just had a chat with him, and he was a really lovely guy.
Now, tell us a little bit about, you made the demo records, but you didn't actually get the release, but you got some success with it. Tell us about that.
Well, we tried to, early on, get a recording contract, because we figured that was the way ahead. And there wasn't much in the way of recording studios around then. I think it was over in Liverpool, but I don't quite know. I can't remember quite how it came about, but we ended up hiring these guys to record the band to do our first demo, and we borrowed a local youth group called the Callister.
I did a lot with the Callister over the years.
So you know that one.
Yeah. In fact, my cousin married the daughter of the owner, of the leader. Well, it's a small world, isn't it?
So we hired the, well, we just borrowed it. I think we were allowed to borrow it one Sunday afternoon when the club was closed. And these guys came along with this sort of mobile unit, which actually turned out to be nothing more than quite a few reel-to-reel tape recorders.
That sounds like Port Sunlight Boys Club or somebody like that, doesn't it?
Yeah. So they set up these couple of mics, one for the singer, one for the rest of us, and it was all done in one hit. There was no overdubbing or anything. The trouble was, with the club being empty, it was very, very echoey. So they kept on asking us to turn down. And in the end, it was so sort of low that there was just no atmosphere. It ended up sounding really quite dull. But we recorded, because at the time we were doing this sort of pretty rough and tough R&B music. The thoughts in those days were that to get a recording contract, you had to do something commercial, something pop. So we wrote a song called Lost and Alone. It was mainly Dave and Alan who wrote it. The rest of us sat on the sidelines and gave encouragement mainly. rearranged it, and it was a presentable little pop tune, no better or worse than anything else that was around at the time, I don't think. And for the reverse side, we picked a blues thing called Anne Kingsley.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was a Slim Harpo composition. And we just got copies of the tapes made and sent them off to recording companies, and they came back with a polite letter saying not what we're looking for at this time, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And they probably weren't even listened to be honest. We should have had the sense to realise that we should have gone down there and knocked on doors and tried to get to see people rather than just sticking it in the post. But
did I remember correctly that you used to have a big-ish van that you used to travel around the town in?
Well, we had a Ford Thames van.
Yeah.
That was covered in messages. girls used to write on the side of it. We never stopped them. It was an old Ford Thames van. We bought it for 50 quid, I think. But none of us could drive, so we were always trying to find somebody to drive us round.
Okay, tell us about when you went to Germany then. How did that come about, and where did you go?
Right, well, the Prowlers kicked off early 64, as I mentioned earlier. And we were doing very well locally. We were pulling in quite good crowds. And we were approached by an agent, a chap called Ken Smith, who ran an agency called Darvel Entertainment, originally based in Quality, I think, moved to out into the world. And he approached us and asked if we'd like to sign up with him and dangled the carrot of recording contracts and trips to Germany and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
We thought, wow, this sounds good. And we had been for some time entertaining the idea that it would be really great to do it full time. I was at art school at the time. I'd moved over to Liverpool Art College by this time. I wasn't particularly enjoying the course that I chose.
Yeah.
The other lads were in regular jobs, but nothing that they couldn't leave to pick up again. So the idea of playing music all the time was very attractive to us. And Ken asked us to audition for the people from this club circuit called the Star Palace Circuit over in Germany. And I think the auditions were held at the Grosvenor Hotel in Wallasey, if I'm not mistaken. And we went on, and we were halfway through the first number when they just waved us to stop, and we thought, oh, well, that's it, we've blown it. But they just said, you know, would you like to do a month in January?
Well, that was good, wasn't it?
It was simple as that, yeah. So we said, oh, yeah, that would be fantastic. So we agreed to do it, and we talked our parents around, and we signed up with Ken's agency, who fixed it all up. And right at the 11th hour, we realised that our drummer, Mally, was still only 17, and you have to be 18 to get a work permit. So, this was something of a crisis. But we solved it by getting another drummer to come along with us and then just taking Mally along for the ride. Because we had this idea that whilst we were away, being full-time, we'd have all these daytimes to practice in and to rehearse new material. And I thought, well, he could be doing that while this other drummer played at night. When we actually got over there, we found that nobody was really bothered. Nobody checked up on anything, so Mally played with us every night anyway, and this other guy was just hanging about all that time to start off. So that was
Is that you or me?
No, that's your end, I think.
No, yours is memory full.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Oh, because we caught the yeah, that's okay. It's because we caught the answering machine before it. I think it's been recording us for the 20 minutes or something as it lasts. You can forget it now. So that was January of 1965. And we went over there because we still couldn't drive at this point, and we didn't want to take a driver over with us who would literally be just sort of kicking his heels for most of the month because we weren't expecting to move around very much.
Yeah.
We were driven down to Dover by Ian's dad in our old van. Then we went over by boat to Dunkirk. And then we went by train right through to Germany through the afternoon, through the night.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about the people that you... I'm looking at your website, obviously, as we're talking, and tell us a little bit about the people that that you played with. You know, I'm looking in particular at people like Goldie and the Gingerbreads, who had... Can't You Hear My Heartbeat, I think, was there, wasn't it?
Right, yeah, good memory. They were a fantastic band, much better than you would think from hearing that single and one or two other things that they put out. They were a much more sort of soul-y band than you might expect, and they were fantastic musicians, and all of them sang, did these great harmony numbers, and we were somewhat in awe of them. They were a little bit older than us, and their organist, who also covered all the bass parts, because she used to play a Hammond organ where you play the bass parts with the feet. And we used to pull our bass player's leg and say, you know, she plays better bass than you with her left foot. they were a terrific band. And in actual fact, our spare drummer that we'd taken over with us, he got to play with them for a few nights because their drummer was taken ill with some sort of stomach bug. So he was being paid by us and being paid by them and having a great time.
Yeah.
We played with... The other fairly big name we played with from that time over there was Screaming Lord Sutch, who was absolutely nuts.
Well, again, there is a connection because down in Cornwall, we lived there for quite a while,
yeah.
And I was the Raving Loonies agent when it came to the elections, just for the publicity,
oh,
you know. Well, I mean, the thing is, for what it cost me to actually put up and do that, it was well worth it just for the, you know, for the publicity.
Yeah.
So there we are. So, I mean, there must have come a point, really, when you'd said, we're not really making it and I've had enough of trying my best. And was that in Germany or was it before you came back to England or was it when you came back?
No, it came quite a bit later because we did three tours of Germany.
Oh, right, okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, we did the January, and then we were asked to go back in April, and also in July of 1965. And in between, we were touring around the UK, going to various places. We went over to Ireland. We did several tours of Scotland. We opened for Manfred Mann on one of them. They were riding very big at that time. That was quite an amusing story. The first night we played with them was in Stirling, I think, in Scotland. And there was, we were playing in this huge sort of market hall place, just a standing audience. And there was a stage set up at either end, a big one at one end for Manfred Mann and a smaller one for us at the other end. And we went on and opened the show. It was a big crowd, about 2,000 or so.
Yeah.
And we were doing pretty well. And but then, just towards the end of the act, when we were trying to bring things to a climax, they of course realised that Manfred Mann would be on soon, and if they wanted to get a good spec, they'd have to go down to the other end of this great big hall. And so the crowd started to drift away, and we ended up playing our last number to the back of 2,000 heads, which was a strange experience.
Yeah.
Well,
I can relate to that because around about 1970, I'd actually done Radio 1 as a guest DJ, and you know,
yeah,
people were booking me because on the strength of that, you know. And I used to do Reese's Ballroom over in Clayton Square,
yeah.
And most of the groups had been on Radio 1 or had a hit or whatever, and we had exactly the same. They'd all come up our end and dance, and then they'd all go back down the other end to watch the band, you know. So I could imagine exactly what you're talking about.
Right. But to get back to the thrust of your question just before about when it started to unravel.
Yeah.
It was going pretty well up to that point. We liked it in Germany, but we felt that the future was in the UK, because Germany was a bit of a backwater compared. compared to the UK, certainly. Even though there was a lot of group activity over there and a lot of people working over there, we didn't feel it was the place to make it. We were offered recording contracts by two companies, by Philips and Polydor, but it was on the understanding that we were based in Germany to promote it all.
Yeah.
So we turned that down because we felt that we had a future in the UK. And we came back and we worked through the rest of the summer and into the autumn. Unfortunately, although we were doing very well in certain venues, we'd signed up a bit hastily with the agency we were with. And a lot of the venues that he had were more kind of sort of cabaret type places, where they wanted the sort of bands who were all smartly suited and singing sort of, you know,
yeah,
quiet, perky pop songs, nice harmony numbers, you know, bands like The Fortunes, you know, that sort of music.
Yeah.
That's what they were looking for, not the sort of R&B that we were turning out. So we went down great with some audiences, but unfortunately, Ken didn't have enough of those sort of venues on his books. So there were quite a lot of places that we went to where, you know, we didn't want to go back again, and, you know, they probably wouldn't want us to go back there. But
yeah,
the work was thinned out, rather. And as we were doing this for a living, and we had an extra person to pay because we, as I said earlier, we didn't drive.
Yeah.
We had had our own roadie, so we had to be paid. And so the money started to thin out a bit. And the first to go was Dave, who felt that he'd had enough. And this was getting fairly close to Chris 65.
Yeah.
And when he left, we decided to carry on just as a four-piece for a while to see how that worked out. It didn't work out terribly well musically. And then, very suddenly, Alan decided to leave. And that left us in the position where the whole band had to be rethought. So we got jobs. And although the name, we kept the name going for a while longer, it wasn't the original Prowlers.
Yeah.
We had various people in and out of the band, but there was the core of myself, Ian MacDonald, and Alex Ellis, me on lead guitar, Ian on bass, Mally on drums, but we had various other people in at different times, but it was never quite the same. Although, you know, we did have a pretty good following over at Cavern. We played loads of times during 1966.
I think if you were good enough to play at the Cavern, then you were obviously a very cotton band, and probably like everything else in life, you know, you just needed a hit, didn't you, really?
Yes, I think so. I mean, my own view, it's funny, there are different views within the band, but my own view was that it was that original lineup that had the magic. And then later, yes, okay, we were competent, but not... For me, the magic wasn't quite the same. I stayed till more or less the bitter end.
Yeah.
And then, you know, came back in other bands later on.
Mm. I know, you know, for myself, you see, I've been to one of the gigs. I can't remember where I would have seen you, but yeah. then I saw the band with the van. But then, of course, you will have gone off to Germany by that time, and of course. I started DJing a little bit later to that, and then I started working at Radio Merseyside. Did you ever come in the Cabin, or the Cabin would have been one you might have come to.
Well, the name certainly rings a bell.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing when you're looking back over all this number of years. A little while ago, we found it was when we were looking for this lost demo tape, which we did unearth, by the way. Ian came across our old booking diary from the days when we used to do it ourselves. And there were venues in there that we played regularly. I was scratching my head thinking, where is this place? Had no recollection of it at all. I'd speak to Ian. He said, yeah, you remember it. He'd remember every last detail about it. And then the next minute, I'd be remembering something quite clearly that he was just absolutely blank about. So I think it's improvement of memory can be very sharp.
Yes.
Also be very selective.
Yes, absolutely. And do you still keep in touch with other members of the band?
Yes, indeed. McNally unfortunately died in early 2008. He'd emigrated to Australia by this time.
Yeah.
I'd been out of touch with him for a while, and then early 2007 he got in touch about something, and we struck up, you know, our friendship again. And, he came over that Christmas of 2007. He wasn't very well then, but didn't think it was anything serious, but he went back and he died very shortly after.
Yeah. That's one of the downsides of doing what I'm doing, which is basically looking at what happened and people that were there. And of course, Radio Merseyside opened in 1969, and I started working on that station, I think it was 1974. And of course, you know, it only came to me while I was in Spain that I should be looking at all the people that you know, I've either come across during the course of my career developing, or people that you know, had an input into this particular phenomenon, which is, I mean, it was a magical time, and I don't think people, even listening to the podcast, will realise just how exciting it was, really.
I think you're absolutely right. There were bands on all over the place, and because of the competition that there was on Merseyside, I think that the standard was very high.
Yeah. And I think also for me, the fact that nobody really was taught any of this in school is really quite interesting, because, I mean, if you look at today, there are courses all everywhere with the chance to learn how to play music and the chance to be coached and obtain stardom, whereas, you know, we've both been through a process whereby you used to go to some really, really dodgy venues and you'd have some very, very dodgy situations as part of your background, you know.
Yes, that is true. We played in some quite shaky places where, you know, you think, well, where are we going to plug in? And this old-looking outlet on the wall, wires hanging out of it.
a few bodies to the side that had burned. Oh, dear, terrible.
I got a terrible electric shock one night at, I think it was a pub over in Liverpool in the very early days, and I had my hands on the guitar and I touched the microphone stand at the same time.
Oof.
Must have been some earthing problem. And I was just kicked across this little stage and straight into the drum kit.
Yeah.
Just like I'd been thrown, physically thrown, and it was only Dave's presence of mind, because he could see that the microphone stuck to my hand, and he gave it a kick and broke the connection.
Yeah. In the meantime, it's been really, really nice having a chat with you, and thanks very much indeed for your time.
Not at all. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Lovely. And if you're ever coming across to Spain, please give me a ring and let me know that you might be near us.
I will, yeah.
That'll be nice.